Time now for an update from the crude life,
the most trusted voice in energy.
Dr. Lauren Z. Scott is part of a 35-year-old firm that provides economic and energy as well as public speaking services for a wide range of clients, including BP, ExxonMobil, Integra Corporation, JP Morgan Chase, Capital One Finance, Nucor, and a diversity of others in the energy and economic sector. Dr. Scott makes 50 to 70 presentations a year on the state of and the outlook of economic and energy sectors and how they particularly intersect. Dr. Scott is also one of the 32-member National Business Economic Issues Council, which meets quarterly to discuss issues of state, national, and international interests. This group has experts who cover international trade, Washington economic policy, retail trade, trucking, steel, chemicals, etc. Dr. Scott has also been appointed to the Economic Advisory Board for the U.S. Council on Competitiveness, a group of CEOs of the Fortune 100, top university presidents, and presidents of the three major unions compile this council. He's been interviewed by hundreds of media outlets, including MSNBC, CNBC, Bloomberg TV, as well as the Financial Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, Moscow Times, and now The Crude Life. Dr. Scott was also part of the Economics Department faculty at Louisiana State University from 1969 to 1998, where he went from assistant professor to the chair of economics. He is presently professor emeritus of economics at Louisiana State University. During his time as chair of Louisiana State University's Economics Department, it rose from 101 to 38, and he received 7 awards for his outstanding classroom teaching at Louisiana State University. Dr. Scott is also the co-developer of the Louisiana Economic Model and model used for annual forecasting for the state economy, which is released every fall. This is Dr. Lauren C. Scott. Quick question, Addie. Saw a news story about some natural gas and oil and gas industry news. Billions of dollars being projected down in Louisiana. Good sir, what's happening down there?
Well, I haven't really seen that specific study before. And unfortunately, from my standpoint, I'm not real crazy about the study because typically I do that work for the Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association. And now that Price Waterhouse is doing this all across the United States, I think they found it cheaper just to use their work. But the industry is still really large in our state. Of course, we have the Haynesville Shale up in the northern part of the state that is a dry gas play. And then, of course, we service through the Port Fouchon down on the coast. We service about 95% of all the offshore oil and gas activity that's going on in the state. I actually did a very detailed economic impact study of the broadly defined oil and gas industry. So I include in oil and gas refining too. We're, of course, the number two refining state in the nation. We have very large refineries here. I think we have the third and the fourth largest refineries in the United States located in Louisiana. And the industry is still really, really critical to us. I think when I did my work back in 2017, which has been a while now, we traced about 262,000 plus jobs in the state that people work directly for these industries or their jobs exist because of the existence of the industry through the multiplier effect. So it's a big sucker. And the thing about the Price Waterhouse study, which is, I'm sure, is very confidently done, very well done. When we do our work, we look at all kinds of other stuff, like how much the industry pays in property taxes and local government revenues and state government revenues. We look at, how it's distributed across the state. We have 64 parishes. We have parishes here to the counties, of course, Jason. And there is some sort of oil and gas activity going on. And all of those 64 parishes except one.
Which one is that?
You know, I was afraid you were going to ask me
pop
that.
Quiz
I
here.
I don't remember off the top of my head.
No, that's
it's
okay.
Small rural parish in the central part of the state, I believe.
Okay, central part of the state. I was going to ask you if the Haynesville is happening up in the north part, and you've got importing, exporting, you've got LNG, you've got all kinds of activity from, you know, Lake Charles all the way across the Gulf Shore there. What are kind of the big bright spots right now in Louisiana for the energy industry?
Well, the number one, of course, in terms of oil and gas extraction, the really bright spot is the Haynesville Shale. And the reason the Haynesville Shale is doing very well right now, the rig count has gone from about 16 to about 45 in the Louisiana portion of the Haynesville Shale. And the reason for that is there has been a tsunami of new chemical firms and LNG export firms that have come into the southern part of the state. And as a result, the chemical firms, and obviously the LNG export firms, use natural gas as their primary feedstock. And so it's important for them to have access to that feedstock and to have it as close by as possible. Well, the closest shale play and to the southern coast of Louisiana is the Haynesville Shale and of course the offshore industry. And so just in response to this big tsunami of new chemical plants and LNG facilities, you've seen the rig count really jump up in the Haynesville.
I'm trying to put dots together in some of our past interviews, which we'll have the links available at the website, thecrudelife.com. We're also available on Substack if you'd like to sign up for the daily Substack newsletter that comes out part of the Crude Life offering now. There was some foreign ownership down in the importing exporting ports, whether it be Lake Charles or some of the other areas. I think a French company, a Saudi Arabia company. I'm pop quizzing myself here too, so I'm not sure if I'm getting all the different companies down. But in addition to some American investment, there was a lot of foreign investment too. Is that where a lot of this is coming from?
Yeah, because what is happening, Jason, is these companies are chasing the cheapest natural gas molecules they can find.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, in the world, the cheapest natural gas molecules are here in the United States. And so if you look at the price of natural gas in Europe or the price of natural gas in Japan, for example, starting in about 2012, that kind of time frame there, right about the time the fracking thing really got started. Since that time period, there has been this humongous gap that has suddenly existed between the price of natural gas here and the price of natural gas in Europe. Just to kind of give you a quick idea, most of your listeners will realize that back in, November or so, we had this big spike in natural gas prices here where the natural gas price got to $7 per million BTU. Well, it was $7 here. It was $71 in Europe. It was $51 in Japan. There's no way that chemical firms in Europe and chemical firms in Japan can compete against chemical firms in the United States when we're paying a lot less for that natural gas. And so these firms are trying to figure out where should I locate in the United States when I come there. And what they're figuring out is the best places to come are on the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and the mouth of Mississippi River and on the Calcasieu ship channel over in Lake Charles and then along the southeastern coast of Texas. And the reason they're coming is, number one, if you look at a natural gas pipeline grid of the United States, what you'll see is just a mass of pipelines along the Louisiana coast and the Texas coast. So they would not only be able to get the cheaper natural gas, there would not only be cheaper natural gas, but they would have accessibility to it. And then the third thing that's nice about this area is that ocean-going ships can come all the way up the Mississippi River as far as Baton Rouge. They can come all the way up the Calcasieu Ship Channel to Lake Charles. And there they can load these bulk chemicals that they're making out of this cheap natural gas. And they then go back into the Gulf of Mexico. They got access to the world markets. So that's the third thing. And then the fourth thing they got down here that a lot of people may not realize, there are a lot of salt domes located in this area, large concentration of salt domes. And out of salt domes, you can make brine. And out of brine, you make chlorine, which is a key ingredient in many of these chemical firm activities. For example, a firm here in Baton Rouge area, Shintech, makes PVC pipe. And they make that out of natural gas, but they have to use chlorine too, which is made out of brine. So we have located in this particular area just a nice combination of four things that are bringing these firms from all over the world to open up plants. So some of these firms are Chinese, some of these firms are from Germany, some of them from France, some from South Africa. They're from all over, and they're like I say, they're chasing those cheap molecules.
I remember back in 2012-13, Lee Tillman, Marathon Oil, was on the program basically talking about what you're saying. How can they get that molecule to South America, over to Europe, in the cheapest possible way? And I know that in countries like Qatar, they've been basically bringing a lot of the American energy infrastructure over there to get set up to help some of the countries in that area. Is that connected at all to this, the infrastructure that's been kind of being built over the last decade?
In which country?
Qatar comes to mind. Was another interview we did on the Crude Life, how a lot of companies were investing in the country Qatar for infrastructure to help with importing and exporting.
What is happening is you have an organization of countries called the European Union, okay? In other words, we call Europe.
Yeah.
Well, Europe has got a problem. They have very large chemical companies, especially in Germany. I mean, BASF has a site in Ludwigshafen, Germany, that has more people employed than the entire chemical industry in Louisiana at that one site. Their problem is they outlawed fracking in the EU. The Greens are very powerful there, so they outlawed fracking. And as a result, they have to import their natural gas from Africa, from the North Sea, or guess who? Russia. Matter of fact, Germany relies about 45% of their natural gas consumption comes from Russia, primarily through the Nord Stream pipeline. And as you know, what Russia has done is they've used that pipeline as a squeeze play on the EU. Anytime the EU starts taking the side of Ukraine, especially right after Russia invaded Ukraine, they would say, we have to do maintenance work on this pipeline. So they cut off the supply just to give Germany a sense of what's going to happen if they totally cut off supply. And they did that a couple of times. And then, of course, somebody sabotaged that pipeline. So what is happening is Europe is having to bring in that extra natural gas through another way, and that is through LNG tankers. And so Qatar saw this, and Qatar has lots of natural gas, so they started building facilities to LNG export facilities. We here in the United States started building them, especially, again, over in the Calcasieu Ship Channel. You've had a number of very large LNG exporters there, a number of large LNG exporters on the South Louisiana coast. And then we have a number of them that are still have announced they're going to build but have not issued a final investment decision yet. We expect a number of those to issue final investment decisions by the end of this year. So what you're seeing is in countries that export natural gas, like Qatar and like Australia, they're investing more in building liquefaction terminals. That is, they take raw natural gas and they liquefy it. They make it very cold. They when they liquefy it, they bring it down to 1/600th of its volume, put it on LNG export ships, then ship it to Europe. And in Europe, what they have is regasification units, which they've been trying to build even more of. So they can take that liquid natural gas, regasify it so that they can use it in power production, chemical production, going to people's residential stoves and that sort of thing. So you've seen a lot of, on the LNG side, you've seen a lot of infrastructure being built especially to help the Europeans through this problem that they've got right now.
You mentioned a couple of the political climates when it comes to energy. What is Louisiana's political bend or political perspective with oil and gas specifically?
It kind of, to no small extent, it kind of depends on the parish you're looking at. There are some parishes that are very open to these firms coming to their parish because they know that when they come, they bring lots of tax money. Because we're talking about plants that may spend as much as $1 billion to $2 or $3 billion building their plant. Well, guess what? That's going to go on the property tax rolls, and local governments are going to collect a slew of money to then fund either public schools, teachers, police forces, and whatever. So you have some parishes that, like Ascension Parish, which is right below me, where the governing bodies, the parish council, the sheriff's department, the school board, all these are very open for business. They say, bring it on. We love having these here. You have other parishes like St. James, which is about halfway between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, where there are a couple of NGOs, with a funny name, Rise St. James, really should be called Depressed St. James. But I think they get most of their funding. They're getting most of their funding from Soros, George Soros, initially. Now they're getting funding from Bloomberg, who's written a check for $30 million to try to stop plastic production in the United States. He wrote that check out, by the way, with a plastic pen, using ink made out of crude oil. And then, as you probably might know, the EPA has recently set aside $300 million for NGOs to battle with the issue of social justice, that where these plants are located is sometimes predominantly near African-American communities. So in St. James Parish, St. James Parish is kind of not open for business. We're kind of closed for business. And so these companies are not coming there. And so, but in general, the state as a whole is very open to firms coming. They're offering something called an industrial tax exemption. They have a deal where you, instead of paying the full property tax in the first 8 years, you only pay 20% of the property tax for the first 8 years. Well, that's a lot of money. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to compete with Texas to get these plants. So we're offering them some tax benefits, some incentives to come here.
You mentioned social justice. That's part of the ESG movement. Have you looked into ESG and energy? You and I have never had a conversation about ESG specifically, so I have no idea where you, I guess, are on that spectrum of environmental social governance. Social justice is part of that. Is that a big part of the economy down there now? Is it kind of bleeding in?
It depends on the parish.
Yeah, okay.
In some parishes, it's become the NGOs that take that on as an issue. In some parishes, they get a good foothold, and like in St. James, and they done a very good job of keeping any industry from coming there, any new industry in particular from coming there. Other places, it has not gained a foothold. You go to Ascension Parish, it has not gained a foothold there at all. My position on this is when you ask the question of is it fair for these plants to be located very close to African American communities, for example, African American subdivisions. My first question is, what came first? Did the plant come first, or did the African American community come first? Because if the plant came first, and then the African American community built next to it, well, then there's no social justice issue here. That you made a decision because the land was particularly cheap there to build your subdivision there. That was your decision. You made it on the basis of what the market said. If the plant is coming in and it's coming brand new and it's coming in right next to an existing subdivision, well, then there's some issues there that have to be dealt with. And a lot has to do with how close your subdivision is to that. Is it right next door? Is it a mile away? Well, I mean, there's a lot. So it's not a real straightforward issue. Of course, I have a very different view of climate change than a lot of people do. I mean, I've looked at the numbers, I've looked at the data, I've looked at the data on, I've looked at what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, I've looked at what they actually said, what those scientists have actually said. I've looked at the data on sea level rise. I've looked at the data on hurricanes and hurricane intensity, on tornadoes, on wildfires, and I believe this is all nonsense. I think what people who really want to look at this issue should ask the very first question any economist would ask, and that is, follow the money. Where is the money? And what you will find is there's huge amounts of money going into NGOs and other groups that are promoting the climate change issue. There's just a lot of money there, and the press has totally bought into it. You'll rarely find the press that does not just wholly jump in there and agree with this. And it's just one of those issues on which I've spoken before, and I think it's all based on nonsense.
About 7 years ago, I actually started speaking on how I believed the climate change movement was more or less going to replace religion, whether they were doing it by purpose or not. And it was mostly because the way that you can connect and feel with the environment is so easy. And the narrative of we've, you know, destroyed the planet, much like Adam and Eve destroyed the Garden of Eden, and there's original sin involved. And, you know, and I was talking more from an anthropological point of view more than anything. And, you know, listening to you kind of talk about the climate change and some of the other things, I've taken a look at Michael Mann's research. It's not accurate, you know, and I've taken a look at some of the other things that are happening on the planet, and what we came with the conclusion is that this is a big planet. There's a lot of chaos that happens on a nightly. Earthquakes happen every day. Thunderstorms happen every day, and you know there's cyclical changes with the dry cycles and wet cycles and that sort of thing. So it's a tough argument nowadays because people are very passionate about it. Where do you rank on, you know, this environmental movement? Do you think this is here to stay, or do you think this is something that's just a fad?
Well, I think when you got the press on your side, and press buys ink by the barrel, you got a formidable adversary if you think that it's not correct. Plus, you're right. For many people, this is like a religion to them. They feel as strongly about that as I do about Christianity, and so it's. I mean, I was recently with a group of four economists, three, four of us together, that we went to graduate school together, and one of the, you know, three of us are in the same camp. We've looked at the numbers, we've looked at the data, and the other guy was just he used the phrase, "I believe in environmental science," and the three of us said, "Hey, we do too. You know, we believe in looking at the data, and if somebody makes an assertion, then I want to see if the data fit what the assertion is." If you look at the data on, if you ask somebody on the street how much the sea level has risen since 1900, the last 125 years, how much has the sea level risen? I bet most of them would say something, you know, 50 feet or 90 feet or something like that. And the correct answer is 9 inches. The distance between, if you spread your hand out, the distance between the tip of your little finger and the tip of your thumb. It's not very much at all. It's something very easy to adapt to, whatever it is. If you ask them what has happened to the level and intensity of hurricanes, they believe that the level and intensity of hurricanes has dramatically increased. As a matter of fact, there was a graph of the number of hurricanes, intensity of hurricanes by year in our local newspaper, and the guy that wrote the article was saying, you can see here just how much worse things have gotten. And if you look at the graph, it's flat. I mean, there's no change. As a matter of fact, there was a period, I think it was from 2005 to 2016, when not a single hurricane hit the coast of Florida, something I think historically never has happened. But that's never brought up, okay? If you look at the data on tornadoes, the incidence and the intensity of tornadoes has not increased since we began to collect data on it, okay? If you look at wildfires, in particular, wildfires are way down from where they were in 1920, way down. There was a big drop-off in wildfires. It's been drifting upward slowly for the last, since about 1983, but it's been drifting upward real slowly. Not real big. So if you look at all these, you actually look at the data on all these measures of how the economy is doing, including the temperature, you'll notice that they no longer call it climate warming. They can't call it climate warming anymore because the climate, the earth is not really warming the way it was at one time, I think in the 90s or so. It's not warming at all like that. It's and so what they did is they came up with this very clever title called climate change. Well, who can argue with the fact that climate is changing? Climate has always changed. Jason, I'm 80 years old. I've been through a period of time when the environmentalists said, if we don't do something, what we're doing is going to cause us all to freeze to death. And then I went through the period of time when they said, if we don't do something, the earth is going to be destroyed by heat. Well, then when we quit heating up, they said, well, now the world's going to be destroyed by climate change. Come on. That's not even a scientific term. It's not something that can be measured. So anyway, like I say, I'm kind of a little passionate about the other side of this argument.
I completely understand. What's kind of the walk away from the economic impact and the energy impact in Louisiana right now for the forecast? You do write the annual forecast for the state of Louisiana economics. What do you see over the next 6 months?
Well, what we're seeing is, again, the Haynesville Shale is doing very well. And because the Haynesville Shale is growing, the other thing that's growing is the pipeline sector. Fortunately, these pipelines can be all built intrastate, so there's not nearly the problems having them built. There are at least six new pipelines that are being built to bring Haynesville Shale gas down to the Gulf Coast. So the pipeline industry is doing quite good, which means the midstream part of that sector is doing quite good, quite well. The offshore is another thing altogether. As you know, when Biden came into office, the first day he was in office, he stopped all lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico. And, of course, we finally had two through a lot of battles. But, by the way, because the the folks who believe in climate change, what I call the climate alarmists, because they are not winning in the state legislatures and really they're not winning in Congress so much. Now what they're doing is they're going to use the judicial system to try to stop a lot of these things. So they're really clogging up the judicial system with all kinds of attempts to stop any kind of expansion in fossil fuels. But the problem in the Gulf of Mexico is, you know, we used to have at one point, probably in 1990, something like that, maybe as early as 2000, I think we had like 120 rigs out there. We now have 16. And we've had around 16 since 2014, since we had the last big drop in oil prices when OPEC pumped all that oil on the market, drove the price down to under 30. Well, the rig count got down to 16. It really hasn't gotten up very much since then. It's kind of hovered in that 16 to 20 range. So a place like Houma, a place that is where Port Fourchon is, it services the offshore industry. The shipbuilding people down there, like Edison Schwest and others, Tidewater and others who build ships to service the offshore oil and gas industry, their business is not very good because offshore, even though it's probably the least carbon intensive type of drilling you can do, has really been under attack. So that part of the industry is not doing too well.
Well, refining
is doing fine.
Oh, what's that? The mining?
Refining is doing fine.
Oh, refining is okay.
Refining is doing real good. I mean, they're doing quite good. They're expanding. And in addition to that, we have a number of firms that are building renewable fuels facilities. They either have announced or they're actually building them. And what they're doing is they're making jet fuel out of wood waste, or they're making jet fuel out of animal fats and all kinds of canola oil and all kinds of other stuff other than crude oil. So you're seeing a lot of these. Shell is getting ready to build, I think, about a $1.4 billion renewable fuels facility down in Convent, just below us. We got a big one right at our port of Baton Rouge, where an outfit called Grown Fuels is going to build a big renewable fuels plant made out of, where the jet fuel is made out of animal fats and canola oil and things like that.
Crazy. Times are changing. I mean, I thought it was when I found out that Benson, Minnesota was powered primarily by turkey poop. I thought that was a bit unusual. So,
yeah, I know.
Oh, boy. Pretty soon we're going to be flying our jets with wood fuel, huh? That's interesting.
Right.
Are you still doing any speaking and still taking any work in?
As a matter of fact, I am. Well, number one, I'm about to go give a speech right now down in Gonzales, which is about 30 miles below us. So I'm getting ready to leave for that today at lunch time. I am still doing, we do a lot of economic impact studies. My firm is still very active. We just finished up some work for Entergy, which is the large power company down here. Because all these new firms are coming into this region, Entergy needs to build some more transmission lines to take electricity to them. Well, they're huge users of electricity. And in order to do that, they've got to go to our Public Service Commission and say, can we build this and put it in our rate base? And so one of the things we do is we try to show the Public Service Commission the economic impact of all these new firms that are coming into the area, so that they will be more inclined to grant Entergy this request for more power lines. So we're working on that. We have a new firm coming in that's come into this very rural central kind of east central part of the state called Sierra Technologies. And what they do is they take graphite, raw graphite from a mine in Mozambique, and they bring it up the river and they refine it into the graphite that will ultimately go into making car batteries. And so we're in the midst of finishing up an economic impact study for them as well. So we're still very busy.
Might have to get you in touch with some of the North Dakota people. I understand they got some graphite up there as well. looking at doing some different research. So fold that in up there as well. But hey, thanks for the time today, and good luck at your speech. Understand you were doing some expert testimonial work this morning as well.
Well, that finished up yesterday, fortunately.
Good.
I was down in New Orleans for 3 days, and again, doing some work on an odd case that involved somebody drilling a well, and it caused the side of a salt dome to collapse, so there's a lot of bickering about who was responsible. So I was involved in that a little bit.
You just got brought in as an expert, huh? Somebody who is gonna kind of tell everybody which way to go. I like that.
Yeah, it's not the most fun job to do, but sometimes it has to be done.
Well, I appreciate the time today, sir, and travel safe. Good luck today.
You too, Jason. Take care up there. Bye-bye.
And that was Dr. Lauren C. Scott. For more exclusive content, visit thecrudelife.com. That's thecrudelife.com. We are also available on Substack, thecrudelife.substack.com.